representations of fictional and punishment narratives. And I'm actually going to ask the speakers to introduce themselves very briefly at the beginning of their talks. What we have is that we have a mixture of practitioners who've moved into the world of telly as advisors. Roger is a documentary maker. And Yvonne
what can you possibly do? Because is that
and Deirdre working directly with prisoners inside prison institutions. So without any to do, I'm going to hand you over, guys. You've got about 5 minutes, okay? And I'll warn you at 2 minutes and 1 minute, and then time, okay?
No pressure.
Yvonne, I think I'd like you to start, if that's okay.
Okay. Well, I think Janet's introduced me well enough, really. I'm a professor of criminology at the University of Bath, and I do have a confession to make. I'm the worst person to talk about prison narratives because I don't really watch media programmes about prisons. It just feels a bit too much like a busman's holiday. But as an academic criminologist and a prison researcher who spends much of my professional life hanging around in prisons, writing about prison conditions and about the lived experience of prisons, and also particularly about the punitive aesthetics of prison architecture and design, I do have quite a lot to say about the role of the mainstream media in making penal practices more visible to a public who are infatuated with incarceration, but fairly ignorant of its effects. And I think our society's deep cultural attachment to the prison as the only solution to offending is in large manufactured and perpetuated by the mainstream media. And a media agenda that regards offenders and victims as mutually exclusive categories, which I think is very problematic, and also which fetishizes ideal victims. So I've got 3 points really that I want to make. The first is that not only do I not watch prison dramas, but I don't watch many crime dramas either. I vividly remember the moment when I thought, actually, I don't think this kind of entertainment is for me, and it was Robson Green chasing serial killers. And I got tired of seeing battered women's corpses on screen and the camera lingering over them in a pornographic way. As we all know, more men are murdered than women in both the UK and the US each year. But I don't remember ever seeing the body of a male character caressed by a camera in quite the same way. And I think, as has already been alluded to this morning, these kinds of portrayals not only cause women disproportionately to fear victimisation and modify our behaviour accordingly, but they shape our perceptions of offenders, which in turn leads us down a particular path of what kinds of conditions of incarceration we think appropriate for convicted offenders. My second point, if I feel compelled to say this given my research, is that better prison conditions don't mean being soft on crime. I recently conducted a 3-year study of prison architecture and design, new build prisons in England and Wales, Scotland, Norway and Denmark. And one of the overarching research questions was, is it the case that a prison is a prison is a prison, regardless of what it looks and feels like to an outsider? And very crudely speaking, and in a nutshell, the answer was yes, loss of liberty is all-consuming. And there's a zero-sum fallacy, I think, whereby criminal justice policy is viewed as a status competition between offenders and victims. In fact, there's arguably a widespread belief that everything that can be done to disadvantage offenders in some way somehow helps victims, and we know that that's not true. So again, as Richard alluded to this morning, and as John Pratt et al. Have suggested, prison is no longer a social laboratory for the purpose of improving its occupants or giving them better life chances, but it's been recast as a repository for society's toxic waste. However, another finding from my research is that architects who are commissioned to design prisons in England and Wales in particular come to those commissions with the same dominant media and cultural repertoires that most of us carry in our heads, meaning that they design according to what they see and fail to design empathetically or imbue the eventual occupants of the spaces that they're designing with any positive qualities or potential to radically transform people's lives. And my final point is that whatever media depictions of the prison tell us, as we've already heard this morning, the reality is that most prisons are pretty mundane most of the time, and Benjamin Zephaniah has written very eloquently about this. But I think there are two important points about this. One is that they are also full of vulnerable people. You know, they're not the sort of scary, evil monsters of media narratives. They're people who are themselves scared and vulnerable. And as we've heard, you know, the reality of prison life wouldn't make for good drama. The writers of the bill always used to say this, that police work is, you know, paperwork, basically. But I think the second and final important point is that the ramping up of excitement and drama arguably matters less in a police drama. In fact, research studies show that the police like being portrayed as action heroes chasing around in fast cars after dangerous criminals. But what we see in relation to prisons and what is absent from our gaze actually have far-reaching consequences when it comes to sentencing and punishment.
Before I kind of give a very short talk, I've worked in Wandsworth Prison and in Rochester Young Offenders Institution, and I'm actually just about to go back into Wandsworth. But what we do, I work for a project called Inside Film, it's my project, is we go into the prison and we give cameras to the people who are serving prisons. Because I think, you know, just listening to some of the things that's been said this morning, the most important thing about the narratives that are told about prisons is that prisoners get the opportunity to tell those narratives. So that's what we do. We go in and we run workshops. We teach them how to use cameras if they don't know. We bring in editing software on laptops, and the prisoners tell their own stories from their own perspective. So yes, all media narratives are constructed, but these are less mediated, if you like, because they're coming directly from the prisoners themselves. So I'll tell you a little bit more about the project after we see some of the clips.
What can you possibly do? Because is that they brainwash people to the bone grizzle. Do you know what I mean? People are like, you stand up and say no, 10 people stand up and say yes against you. Is that you feel like, and not just the people who are eaten off the system and stuff like that. I'm talking about people who are being fucked by the system. They will turn on like against you instead of fighting with you. So it's a bit, I don't understand. It's a bit like they say, it's a bit political.
You know, society's messed up, right? Never let you be you. Or try to put you in categories. And the funny thing is, all I've ever wanted out in this life is to be me. It is said, show me your friends and I will tell you who you are. What does this picture tell you?
Yo, Hess.
Yo, brother.
I just came from another world.
Where is this?
In London, bruv.
We are in London, man.
The other London.
Oh, hey, bruv.
Nah, mate, I'm a server as a judge.
You better show me what you're on about then, bruv.
I don't live here, okay?
I can't, darling, I'm so rash.
Another time we're running.
So what we've learned so far about this place is that everyone's running late, boy.
And yeah, that's what it basically is. The question that we're going to be asked is why this area is so rich, and obviously our areas, I'm from Peckham by the way, is so poor, do you know what I mean? And how we could resolve this rich and poor gap, because trust me guys, it's far from each other, like, believe me.
Today, we launch our welfare reform bill. It brings about the most ambitious, fundamental and radical changes to the welfare system since it began. And at the heart of this bill is a simple idea. Never again will work be the wrong financial choice. Never again will we waste opportunity. We're finally going to make work pay, especially for some of the poorest people in our society. Don't believe what they say. They will make you pay.
intimidated by education. I felt intimidated by academics because I had this idea that they were all geniuses, that they had some sort of some sort of special power or something, I suppose. And one of the things that really, I always believed that they knew more about everything than I did. And I suppose it stayed with me for a long time. And when I first came into university, the thing that really upset me, I think, was the fact that one of some of the people studying sociology and that sort of thing, they seemed to know more about me than I did.
Hello, mate.
Hello, mate.
Yeah. My name's Danny.
Jamie, mate.
Nice to meet you, mate.
Beautiful.
Fucking murder, mate.
Cattleman. Sup? Green gate, green gang. Green gate, green gang.
Thunder!
Yo! Yo, black man, chaser. I'm a gang.
Bang a whack.
Anytime it's street flood.
I'm a bang my hammer.
I ain't bang your nails.
Nails on the head.
You always talking about fans. You hit the nails on the head. Fuck this thing, brother. We're laying him in the head.
I can do anything. I can do magic. I can do this. And look at this. I can do this. And I can do this. Isn't she lovely?
Jimmy, a contract like this should have been signed ages ago.
Look, my son is a reasonable boy. But he needs to hear the answer to his final appeal. He can't sign while there's still a chance he may leave.
Gibson will sign it.
And what if he doesn't? What if he doesn't? It's today. £2 million pay-per-view sales. We'll lose it all if your client doesn't sign it. Fuck his appeal.
I'm just going to say a little bit about the project. So, I mean, I want to talk about prisoners in the context of neoliberalism and the criminalisation of the working class, which, and I know we should talk about, we don't question schools as institutions, but I actually think that some of us do question schools as institutions. Diane Ray, the educationalist, said that, you know, schools were started up, state schools, to police and control the working class, in exactly the same way as I would argue that prisons are there to police and control the working class and to demonise them. I think, you know, if I'm right, New Labour created something like 3,600 offences, were they? New offences, were they? 3,600 offences. And mostly that affected working class people. So I think it's really important to see prisons in that kind of context. And the aim of the Inside Film Project is to explore the potential of a radical pedagogy of film. I teach film and I'm a filmmaker, so I'm not a criminologist. As a way of providing working class people, and most of the people, if you have been in prisons, and most of the people in prisons are from the working class. And so it's a way of providing working class people with an education that fosters the development of a critical awareness around issues of representation as they relate to class, gender, ethnicity, sexuality, religion, and of course prisons and the way in which crime is represented. And the students who take part in the project, and these are all people who are either in prison, some of these films were made in prison, some were made outside of prison with people on probation, and they've all been excluded in many ways, ultimately by their status as prisoners, but this is preempted by their pre-prison identity as working class, or as coming from ethnic minorities, or being unemployed, or homeless, uneducated, drug users, as Yvonne just said, you know, people that a neoliberal society has no use for, so they just end up being warehoused in prisons. And I'm not using the notion of social exclusion in this instance as a catch-all expression to present the inmates as a homogenous mass that remain invisible behind the prison walls, but rather to bring attention to the discourse of social exclusion that functions to negate the issue of social class and the unequal distribution of wealth, and putting in its place programs to include those previously excluded in the social and cultural life of the country, but on terms that don't question that exclusion, yeah? I think one of the most significant steps we can take is to stop talking about social inclusion, exclusion or inclusion or underrepresentation or the way that we represent prisoners, and begin to talk about discrimination. Because what we've got here is discrimination against the working class in all areas. So what the project does, as I said, it runs cameras and editing workshops, followed by ideas sessions that involve scripting, storyboarding and casting. And we also explore the theoretical and historical aspects of film and filmmaking. And we look at representations of prisoners in mainstream popular culture, because as people have said this morning, that's one of the ways that we learn about prisons. It's one of the ways that we learn about crime. It's one of the ways that we learn about working class. And what happens is those kind of representations often link to other kind of representations of the working class. So the ones that politicians use around scroungers and hoodies and, you know, people who spend all their money on phones and don't buy food, you know, those kind of discourses then get linked to other discourses. So they don't work in isolation. And you get them in education as well, yeah, and in the legal system. So you build up a picture of the criminal. And you know, you often hear about that, like, prison doesn't work. But I would argue that prison does work, because if you want a whole group of people who are kind of warehoused away so that they don't cause a problem and they don't have to be dealt with, then prison works. Prison works perfectly. Because that's what happens. Working class people just get warehoused. You know, and I've, like, some of the people that I've worked with in those films, I mean, one of the guys, and it's interesting, I'll stop, and I'm going over, but just that idea of voice and listening to prisoners. When we made the rap in Rochester, Young Offenders, the guys rapped about their mums, and they rapped about gangs, and they rapped about knife crime, and we were told not to show the film, because it didn't show Rochester Young Offenders in a good light. So actually, when these guys are engaging with what they do, and when they are talking about their lives and the things that are important to them and affect them, it's shut down. In another one, when another one of the prisons that we were in, we had to have all the films had to be looked at before we could show them, so that they, I don't know if it's still in place, but there used to be something in place that the public accountant, I think in Holloway Women's Prison, they ran a stand-up comedy course, and the Sun got hold of it, or the Daily Mail, and there was a big fuss about it. So now there's a kind of, before you can show the films, you must make sure that the Daily Mail can't say these prisoners are having a good time. Yeah, you've got to make sure that it's educational, and that's how we get in. Actually, we get in through the education department. That's how we get our access, because it's just a group of volunteers. We go in and we run it for free. So yeah, I'll stop now. Sorry.
Thank you very much.
I was waiting for you to go on. Oh, sorry, just taken out of batting order there for a minute. Great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. My name is Jeff Hughes. And I've spent over 30 years now in about 200 prisons. I was a prison governor for quite a lot of that time. I was the governor of a women's prison in Staffordshire. I was the governor of Cardiff Prison, and I was the governor of Belmarsh, which, as you know, is probably the top security prison in the country. I also spent a number of years working for two chief inspectors of prisons, going round criticising my colleagues, which is why I ended up being the governor of Belmarsh, I think, because nobody else wanted it. People sometimes ask me how you get to be a prison governor. I say, well, I started as a prisoner and worked my way up, and they're never sure whether to believe me or not, but it's not true. A quick 1 minute or less history lesson, because I think in the history somewhere are the roots of perhaps where we are now, and some of the cultures and some of the things we experience go back a long, long time. So if we go back to before prison sentences, where if you were found guilty of something, you were either executed or you were transported. Initially to America, and after the Civil War, the Americans didn't want our criminals anymore. They were going to send them to Africa, and that didn't happen, and that's why we ended up sending people to Australia. And the Victorians identified what they called a criminal class, and as far as they were concerned, the criminal class should be removed from society, and sending them all the way to Australia seemed a pretty way of doing that. When the Australians didn't want us anymore, and actually things got pretty brutal in Australia, which is another reason why it was stopped. Norfolk Island, if you read about Norfolk Island, it was horrific. That was one of the reasons it was stopped. We started building prisons in this country where people would serve sentences. And even then, this idea of removal was, there was a silent system. Some of you will know about the silent system, where prisoners weren't allowed to talk to each other, they weren't allowed to talk to staff. They were kept physically separate. When they went to church, for example, they couldn't see other prisoners. When they went on the exercise yard, they had to wear a mask so that they couldn't identify friends or associates or whatever. This is called the silent system. I think it fell apart when we realized that we actually have to put more than one prisoner in a single cell, which sort of drove a bit of a hole through the silent system, because they could talk to each other in there, couldn't they? And so but they were still hidden and they were still isolated, even though they weren't in Australia anymore. So that's roughly the history. To a certain extent, some of those things, I think, still exist. Communications in particular. It's difficult for prisoners who are inside to communicate with the outside. And equally, we've heard how difficult it is sometimes for people to get into prisons to see what's going on. I'm delighted that today to meet Roger Gray, who I don't think I've seen for 27 years. And we were just exchanging. I was the deputy governor at the time at Brixton Prison, which was built, which was in operation before Belmarsh was built. So it was the top security prison in London, effectively. And Roger was given permission, unlimited access to Brixton Prison at that time, 27 years ago, and spent, I've forgotten, several weeks at least, just wandering around Brixton Prison filming
F-
pretty
I
well.
Never forget F-Wing.
F-Wing, seeing virtually whatever. F-Wing was the healthcare wing, which was actually a bit of a disaster area, but nevertheless he was allowed free access of that too. So in terms of access, we've probably gone backwards in terms of allowing filmmakers and storytellers to come into our prisons, which is a shame. The result of that is that some of the historical things still persist. As recently as last Saturday, my local paper in South Wales was talking about a new, brand new prison in North Wales. And it was the super prison. The prison allows it's going to allow inmates. I mean, personally, I don't like the word inmates, and a lot of prison people don't, because it's sort of linked with psychiatric hospitals and asylums and whatever. It's a bit historical. You will rarely hear me using the word inmate. I just don't like it. Because it's got the wrong associations. But it's talking about the guards in this brand new prison. And prisoners are going to be given their own keys so they can lock the cell from the inside. And just the whole headline of that, we don't call guards, we haven't got any guards in this country, but it's meant to hit the nail for the general public who should be outraged by the fact that guards will have to knock on the door so that the prisoner can unlock the cell from the inside. And then the story just goes on and on and on. So we're talking about guards. I've run out of the number of times, I've forgotten the number of times I've corrected scripts where warders arrive on the scene. The warder does this, the warder does that. We did away with warders by law in the 1920s. So nearly 100 years on, people are still talking about warders. Why? Well, because prison officer doesn't sound quite as sexy and quite as spicy as a prison warder, does it? Or a guard, for that matter. We don't call police officers bobbies anymore, or peelers anymore, do we? So why are we still calling prison officers warders when they were done? Wardresses, even worse, female prison officers. And the press love it. Again, I'm just saying this because it's so up to date. This was last Saturday in the same paper, drug gang locked up for over 70 years. Well, they weren't. That's factually incorrect. It was a gang of 23 people. They were a drugs gang. They got sentences of ranging from 6 months to one person got 10 years. And in between, people getting 6 months, some were suspended sentences. The headline would give you the impression that they were all locked up for 70 years. Simply not true. And this is the information that the public are getting and are basing their knowledge of what's happening in their prisons. Rehabilitation is not a good story. It doesn't sell newspapers. It doesn't sell books. Two purposes for imprisonment. First of all, there's the penalty, if you like, and lots of people wouldn't necessarily disagree with that, the punishment element. But the second element should be there should be at least some element of trying to prevent the next victim or to result in the person not coming back to prison because they haven't reoffended. And that sort of rehabilitation does go on in our prisons. Every prison has got an education department. There are courses going on, offending behaviour courses. There are skills training going on. There are lots of things going on in prisons which don't get any traction at all. Why? Because they don't sell newspapers. And yet they're a very important part of prison life. And that public perception is that prisons are full of murderers and very violent people. Just simply isn't true. So who do we see then when we're looking at films, books, magazines, whatever? Well, it depends. It depends on the context. And I've been thinking about this for a few days, really. The context of what the prison story is trying to do is very important. Is it the whole purpose of the book or the film? In which case, there should be some accuracy in it. Is it just a subplot? You know, the main plot is something and the subplot is something else going on altogether. Is it about the prison as a whole? Is it incidental to the prison story? Okay, there's a really good story going on. It just so happens that this guy is going to be in prison, and it's incidental, really. And the result of that, really, is it depends on how much research the author or the writer wants to put into it. If it's just an incidental bit of the whole story, it's probably not worth the effort, and we won't bother much. If it becomes more important, then more research should go into it. What about the characters? The characters, well, the officers are portrayed as warders or screws or guards very often. Very, very quickly. They are stern. They have no humour. Prisons run on humour. The best prison programme ever was Porridge. If they speak at all, it's orders, it's shouting. The characters of prisoners are always up to no good. They're plotting, they're drug dealing, they have problems which we're sorting out on the visits with their family. We forget about the remand prisoners. About 15,000 people of our prison population are on remand, unconvicted. Nobody ever mentions those. We're very punitive in Britain. When I joined the prison service, we locked up 40,000. There are now 85,000 people in our prisons, more than doubled in my career. And very, very finally, it depends on the context. A lot of it is nonsense in some of the things you see on telly. Sometimes it's inaccurate. Sometimes it's lazy writing. Sometimes it's lacking knowledge. And sometimes they're well-researched. There's a real mixture. But my view is if society wants prisons to exist, and they do, then they have some responsibility for what goes on in their prisons, in their name, and to do that, they should have a knowledge of what is going on, and that should be accurate. And if you watch Line of Duty last night, final quote, if you watch Line of Duty last night, did anybody watch Line of Duty last night? There was a very short prison piece of the guy who was in prison, or supposed to be in prison, and he was being visited by somebody who's behind a big glass screen with a mesh at the bottom. They went to touch hands, and he was shouted at by a guard, no touching. That screen and that visits arrangements just wouldn't happen in our prisons. Very inaccurate. Spoiled the whole programme for me, I have to say.
Roger. Okay, thank you very much, and thanks for fitting me in after all this. I'm Roger Grafe. I'm a filmmaker and a criminologist. I've been a visiting fellow here since 1995, and I've been a visiting professor since about 2002. And I'm very pleased to be part of this, because the conversation I have with the criminal justice system and the public is as a kind of mediator between the academic world, which I take very seriously and respect very many of the people involved here, and the general public and the Daily Mail. I mean, one of the most wonderful opportunities for me is to write for the Mail, because I can write quickly now, having practiced enough. And I, at one point, I had the highest compliment possible, which was that I was actually attacking their obsession with the Bobbies on the Beat. And the editor said, we'll publish it and we will change it. But they put a black box around it, which I thought was, you know, that's
really you're right
on the money. Anyway, one thing I want to do, just before I get into this, is to correct something that Jeff said. Forgive me for doing this, but Norfolk Island, which was designed to be horrible, was briefly occupied by the governor of... was a man called Alexander McConaughey, mm-hmm. who transformed it and said to the worst prisoners in the whole of the Port Arthur system who were sent there, if you behave, I'll take your chains off, and I'm going to teach you music and gardening and cooking and all sorts of life skills. And during the period that he was there, it worked. It was amazing. But when the word got back to the Home Office in London, they were so, which took 7 months, they were so horrified that they sacked him from London. Then the governor of Port Arthur, who had hired him, found out that he was going to be sacked. He sent another note, which took 7 months, and it didn't arrive in time, and poor old Alexander McConaughey had to leave. But the point about that experiment is that the language of representation of the whole criminal justice system, but particularly prison, is to send a message. You've heard that phrase over and over again. We need longer sentences to send a message, right? Now, to whom exactly is this message going? Well, obviously to the Mail, and because they are terrified of that. And when I was advisor to the Home Office, every time I suggested things like letting more people out on license, the Home Secretary, Jack Straw, at that point, said, you know, oh, the Mail, you're absolutely right, but the Mail would have me for breakfast. Mm-hmm. And when I said, look, you know, there's a majority of 167 or whatever it was, and it was like the first month, if you weren't going to do it now, when would you do it? And he said, you don't understand politics, right? And 7 years later, Harry Wolfe made a speech on Sunday of the week saying first-time burglars shouldn't automatically be jailed. On Tuesday, Derry Irvine, the Lord Chancellor, said, I agree with the Lord Chief Justice, and I happened to be having lunch with the head of the Youth Justice Board, and we invited this Charles Faulkner, Secretary, Solicitor General, to lunch, and we said, whatever you do, keep quiet. Right? Just let the debate happen about whether you send people to prison or not. And for the second time in 7 years, the suggestion of reducing the prison population was met with, Roger, you don't understand politics. And that afternoon, number 10 attacked the Lord Chief Justice and the Lord Chancellor, and the next day he quit, the Lord Chancellor quit. Right? And you just think, this conversation is closed. It's so hard to get into the conversation with what I'd like to think of is evidence. And the reason why I'm privileged to be involved with the Mannheim is the films I make, and you heard several of them being quoted already this morning, are trusted as evidence, right? They really are evidence. And the series I did on called In Search of Law and Order about ways of keeping young people out of prison, I showed to a whole bunch of ministers, I showed it to the DPP and their staff, and I want these films, and the Rape film that somebody was mentioning to me is still being used. Yvonne kindly said that Feltham Sings was an influential film for her. And what I'm really saying is that in relation to Paul Rock's remarks earlier about authenticity and the boredom of people telling the same story, is that if you take the time to watch, if you go in with an open mind and an open camera, as it were, and just let people function in their normal lives, and you watch it, and then you check it, which we always do with the participants afterwards, and say, is it accurate? Is it, we protect confidentiality. Then what you've got is a record which I hope has this precious word which Paul mentioned, authenticity. Because that really is at risk in all of this. And the real problem is, most people think they know what happens in prison until they get there, right? And if you think about people like Taki and Jonathan Aitken and so on, and I have some time for Jonathan Aitken, because he allowed himself to be shocked. And one of the reasons by what he saw when he was inside and started helping people, he realized that 40% of the people in prison have learning difficulties and may be illiterate, and he started to teach people to write, and he sent notes and so on. And what happens over and over and over again is that when people get into prison, they discover that the fictional version which they bought isn't right. And I commend to you all a website called BetweenTheBars.org, which is written, handwritten pieces by prisoners in America, say, and almost all of them say, I want to do something about the myths about prison, because when I got in here, it's completely different. And they mentioned small things like, it costs more money to make a phone, a collect call in the state that their prisoner's in than to make an international call. Right, okay, thank you. And I just thought I would tell you, how many people have actually seen Feltham Sings? Does anyone know what I'm talking about? A couple have had. Well, Feltham Sings is a musical set in Feltham Young Offenders, okay? And when I offered, I was given access to it at just the point when it was declared one of the worst prisons in Europe by the Council of Europe. And a young Asian boy had been killed by his racist inmate, co-inmate, cellmate, the day before he was being released. You know, it couldn't have been worse. And in terms of the narrative we've been talking about, that was what you call a horror story, and actually was done as a play very interestingly as well at Stratford East. But I went in there and said, look, I've got access to this prison, and let's see what happens. And Peter Dale, the head of documentaries, I've never forgotten, said to me, oh, God, he said, nobody's going to want to see this stuff. It'll just be full of whinging youth talking about their childhood, you know, and it'll only be watched by muesli-eating people in sandals, you know, who regard him. Forget it. And I just thought, I'm sitting here with this amazing access, and this is what they got here. What the Channel 4 said. Anyway, he turned to me and said, how about Feltham the Musical? And I just laughed and said, why not? So I took it to the Home Office and the prison service, and they all laughed and said, why not? Took it to the prison governors, and they said, and laughed, why not? And Feltham Sings, we won the BAFTA that year for best documentary, not entertainment show, in which the singers were all prisoners, young people, young offenders, and the prison officers also, some of them, took part, although the rest of them thought the whole thing was completely bonkers. But what was interesting about it in terms of Dave's project is that there were two guys. We said to them, look, if you write, and we'll do interviews, serious interviews with you, and then set that to music with Simon Armitage, who was writing the lyrics, right, a great poet. And that all worked beautifully, except for two very tough guys who were in for armed robbery. And both of them said, listen, we don't want white guys telling us about our lives, writing about our lives. We're geniuses too. And so we said, okay. And they did rap songs. And the people who may have seen the film may remember that we opened with one of the rap songs. We used them like 3 to 4 times, much more than anyone else. And they steal the film. They are brilliant. The lyrics are fabulous. The performance is fantastic. Right. And all I'm saying is that the lesson for me about authenticity and evidence, and people, the mantra about evidence-based policies, talk about fake news. I mean, they just don't like it if it challenges the fixed default method of sending a message. Well, the message I want to send is, along with what Jeff was saying and others this morning, there are very, very interesting people behind bars, mm-hmm. both in uniform and they're sent there. And all they really need to do is have attention paid to them. Mm. And that's a very rewarding thing that I've had the privilege of doing most of my life. Thanks.
I think one of the things that's really interesting in the full presentation series is that we've really got into political attitudes and how it affects the representation of prisoners, which is really important, and the links, of course, with socioeconomic factors and how important they are in terms of prisoners' lives. And there seems to be this kind of disconnect, doesn't there, between the Daily Mail and the way that the Daily Mail operates and the understanding of people who are working on the ground in terms of thinking about prisons. So I wonder how you all feel about what we need to do to try and change the political discourses. So why is it that the Daily Mail dictates how people feel about prisons and whether or not the fictional representation of prisons plays into the punitiveness that we experience in society? Who wants to start? Anyone? Do you want to start?
Okay. I've also had that experience, talking to people in the Ministry of Justice about the new prisons currently being planned and designed, the Daily Mail agenda and the question, would it pass the Daily Mail test, were constant refrains in the Ministry of Justice. And it is hugely disappointing to me that it seems to be the Daily Mail that is dictating penal policy in this country. But we did talk this morning a bit about standard narratives, and I wonder how true that really is. It's something that's perpetuated within those kinds of circles. I'd love someone to do some really proper, sustained research on what the public actually think about people in prison, because we don't have that. But the little studies that have been done all suggest that the public aren't as punitive as they're often thought to be.
If I may say so, Mike Huff has done that work.
Yeah. Oh, no, no, I know. Yes,
room for plenty more.
Yeah. But I think that there's something to be done about the current situation where the Daily Mail just seems to have a disproportionate amount of influence. And the question is, how do we disrupt that? And I think it's a bit of a failing of criminology, actually. You know, Richard and Ian Loder have talked about public criminology. Why are we as criminologists not penetrating those debates and actually having more influence with politicians?
Two things, really. First of all, when you get involved in conversations in the pub, as you all do, and you say you've got something to do with prisons or criminology or whatever, the stock reply is often, not always, but often, oh, you should lock them up and throw the key away. That is the public perception, which is based on a lot of the stuff that we've heard maybe this morning. They deserve it. They've done this. Lock them up and throw the key away. But when you pursue that just a little bit more and say, well, actually, that's not going to happen. Virtually everybody that's in prison is going to come out, some sooner rather than later. And they're going to be back in your area pretty soon, within months probably. What you really want to happen in prison. And then they will say things like, well, I want them to stop stealing cars, breaking into my house and being a nuisance around in where I live. And then you can develop that argument by saying, well, that's not going to happen, actually, if you lock them up and throw the key away. There should be things that are going on in prisons which will help to break that cycle, whatever that may be. And prison staff should be pretty good, and a lot of them are very good, at identifying what might help. If somebody's coming into prison who's illiterate, and a lot of them are, levels of literacy and numeracy are pretty low, then clearly the education department ought to be involved in something along the line. But moving on from that and a bit more constructive in terms of how we can change public opinion, there are now a lot of companies, 140 at last count and more probably, who are involving themselves in working inside prisons, apart from lots of volunteer groups, and there are loads of those, but well-known companies like Halfords and Greggs on the High Street, Timpsons, there are loads of them, Marks & Spencer's, Virgin, and a lot of them are now seeing something in prisons where they can get involved in training people whilst still in prison. Drake Hall Women's Prison has got a Halfords workshop, they're calling it an academy, where people are trained, they're employed whilst in prison, they wear the Halfords livery, the whole thing. And if they're any good and if they want to, they will get a job on release. And having a job on release is one of the key features in reducing reoffending. Now, if those 150, 140 well-known companies get together at some point and say, well, we're actually quite a powerful voice, aren't we, in re-educating the public, who we have another interface with in on the high street, that may be one of the ways of changing public opinion.
Just a couple of things. I think first thing we need to think about is how we define crime. So usually what we talk about when we define crime is one-on-one crime, and as people have said, violent crime. We very rarely talk about white-collar crime or corporate crime. So they're not discussed in the way that, you know, a kid who's got no money, that's grown up on a council estate, whose parents have got to work just to pay the rent, so he does something that's defined as a crime. So you get the end result. You don't get all the things that led up to him doing that. Whereas, you know, corporate manslaughter, I think there's never been a corporate manslaughter prosecution in this country. Yeah, so you can cut all the corners you want. People are living in really bad conditions because there's no law in this country that says you have to make flats habitable before people can live in them. And the Grenfell, actually, yeah, absolutely. No one's been prosecuted for that. So I think one of the things we need to start doing is redefining crime and redefining it in the public sphere. The other thing I think we need to think about is in terms of education. If we're going to have prisons and we're going to have education, I personally don't think educating people to work in Halfords and Greggs is a good idea. I mean, people should have a proper education, in a proper, you know, an education for its own sake. You know, just a kind of bit of personal biography. I mean, I left school at 16 with no qualifications, went to university when I was 35 and now have a PhD. My life changed drastically from being a single parent on a council estate that was doing cleaning to being someone who's been invited to speak here because of my PhD. So I think everyone should have the opportunity to do that. If I had just been sent to Greggs, I'd probably still be living on a council estate and doing cleaning on the side. So I think it's really, really important that we don't think, you know. And Joe, I don't know if any of you know Joe, who was talking, he runs a project called Open Book at Goldsmiths University, which gets ex-prisoners onto courses. And a lot of them go for university, do undergraduate degrees, and then do MAs. And like Joe said, when he was in prison, what he was offered was a forklift truck driver. And like he said, that's why he was in there anyway, because he was bored shitless doing that job and he didn't want to do it. He's been the longest time out of trouble since he did his degree, his history degree. So I think it's really important that we think about it in those terms, that people should be treated equally. So it's not just about prisons, it's about all the institutions and the way in which working class people are represented. And if we're only seeing working class people on reality TV shows where they're just entertainment for the middle classes, then I don't think things are going to change. And I really don't think things are going to change until we have more working class people in the public sphere. And at the moment, we don't have, you know, I think the Sutton Trust research has shown that all the professions where decisions are made are dominated by privately educated Russell Group graduates who, you know, filter everything through their own perspective. That's not necessarily to blame them, but, you know, if you're going to filter working class life through a middle class perspective, then you're not going to have any authentic sense of what working class life is like.
Sorry, going back to the question you posed, Jenna, about what to do about the Daily Mail. I just want a quick story. When I was in, I spent a year in Wandsworth filming the relations between the prison officers and the governor, which started out with the governor wanting to do a constructive regime and ended with a threat of privatization and a strike that lost by like 2 votes. So it was a very lively year. And a man called Chris Williams, who's a features editor of the Mail, rings me up and says, "I hear you're inside the POA." I said, "Yes, Prison Officers Association." I said, "Yes." Said, "Well, would you write about what it's like inside the POA?" "Yes, sure." And he said to the number of words, and the money was very good. And he said, "Right, there's only one thing," just as we were about to hang up. He said, "Our readers don't want to read anything good about the POA." And I said, "Well, look, Chris, I get access because I'm fair and accurate and so on. And reliable, really." He said, "Oh yeah, we want you to be fair and accurate, just don't write anything good about it." That is a verbatim quote about how the narrative is repeated and repeated, okay? So the answer to your question is, we have to change the narrative. Now, it may mean that Jordy Grigg has to be arrested and sent to prison, where he will discover the reality of it. But building on what you were saying, and really the problem about that every time I've had the experience of introducing people from the outside world to either prison or prisoners, they are pleasantly surprised. Mm. And it's really interesting. When I was on the education project for the Howard League, we took a whole bunch of people to Pentonville, and they had lunch with the, that was Wormwood Scrubs, we had lunch with prisoners, 3 executives with 1 prisoner. And the bus back, they were all just saying, you know, how interesting, you know, and they're in prison? Is it yes? Well, they've done something wrong because they had to. Mm-hmm. But if you want to change their lives, you know, you have to engage mm-hmm. with that question. Mm-hmm. Give them something else to do. Now, one last thought, and it's a very interesting one in relation to this. There's a criminologist called Ulla Bondesen, who was in Copenhagen and Oslo and Stockholm. And she did a meta-analysis of all the meta-analyses of prisoners that had been going on across the world. And it's from the 90s, isn't it? Early 90s, I think. And it's a bell curve of attitudes for prisoners. They come in saying, "Oh, I'll never do this again. That's a terrible mistake," including Swedish open prisons. They say that. It goes down as they join the prisoners' values of being hostile and feeling like victims themselves. And about a week or two, or just the period just before release, goes back up saying, I'll never do it again, right? So you've got, as it were, the prison experience, which exactly what Yvonne was saying, doesn't matter what the architecture is, doesn't matter what the regime is, and people don't understand that. This whole idea of sending a message is complete crap, and that's the thing we have to do. And evidence from the Netherlands, again, about a very interesting study in Germany, West and East Germany, about speeding penalties, which were much higher in one than the other, and I actually can't remember which was which, but they did an analysis of how the public attitude towards speeding was affected by this. And do you know what the difference was? Nil, because none of them knew what the penalties were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that we time and time again, the Kansas City police experiment, the same thing, half doubling the police in one side of the city and emptying the cars from the other, nobody noticed. And so there's a way in which the fictional version lives in people's heads, untouched by experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And our job is to get the experience into the conversation.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a brilliant place for us to stop, actually, in the sense that we are going to go into the breakout groups, and I think you've set the topic for discussion there, really, about how we actually achieve that and what are the issues that are there. So between 1 and 1.30 then, back into your groups, please, outside, and lunch is also served outside at 1.30.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, at 1.30. And now's your opportunity to talk to one another and to debrief some of these issues that we've discussed. We also just want to thank all our speakers, actually, before you all disappear.
I know the name. I'm trying to think of the sequence of who, because originally when